U.S. versus Banks, 133527. Mr. Uller?
Pardon me, Your Honor. Just one moment.
No problem.
Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. May it please the Court. My name is Joshua Euler. I represent Victor Banks. The primary issue in this appeal is whether this Court can meaningfully evaluate the sentence the District Court imposed for reasonableness in light of the Court's failure to consider the specific circumstances of Mr. Banks' crime. There are two secondary issues the appellant raises in this appeal. The first is whether the court's failure to calculate the guideline range during the sentencing hearing was a procedural error, and the second issue is whether, assuming the sentence, the procedure of the sentencing was not erroneous, whether the substantive or the sentence was substantively reasonable. I concede that on that issue, the appellant has a significantly uphill battle. I'm not going to spend much time on those issues this morning. Going to the primary issue, I think it can be looked at really in two separate ways. The first is whether as a failure to consider the defendant's principal non-frivolous argument in mitigation, or it can be looked at as a failure to consider the nature and circumstances of the offense under 18 United States Code Section 3553A1. Obviously, the sentencing procedures recommended by this court and the Supreme Court and the Rita and Gall line of cases are pretty well established, and the court is to begin the sentencing hearing by calculating the guideline range, which Judge Randa did not do, and then go on to evaluate the 3553A factors. And the court, district court, indicated that that was its procedure.
Well, before we go further, on this issue about calculating the guidelines, the PSR had a calculation, right?
Correct.
The written statement of reasons has a calculation.
Correct.
Is there any indication anybody was confused about what the guideline range was?
I think there was some indication that at the outset of the hearing, the pre-sentence itself recommended a guideline range of, or concluded that the guideline range was 41 to 51 months. There was an addendum that was filed that recommended a guideline, indicated the guideline range was 30 to 37 months.
Everybody in the courtroom knew that.
It would appear so, and certainly it would be totally appropriate to draw that inference.
Obviously, it would be better if there were an explicit finding, offense level X, criminal history level A, range 30 to 37, but we really don't, it's hard for me to see a serious problem here.
I would agree that there's not a serious problem, but I think in the totality of that relatively minor problem with what I believe is the more significant problem, which is why I want to focus today on the court's failure to address these arguments. 3553A1 directs courts to consider the history and characteristics of the defendant and the nature and circumstances of the offense. And I think the key word here is and circumstances. The district court considered the history and characteristics of the defendant to a reasonable extent, and obviously those factors didn't bode very well in favor of the defendant. The court evaluated the nature of the offense generally, the nature of gun crimes generally. But the defense presented several specific factors, and it was the core argument presented in both the sentencing memorandum and again on the record at the sentencing hearing, that the specific circumstances of Victor Banks' possession of the firearm on the date of the offense were fairly mitigated. And the government doesn't really dispute in its response that the court didn't consider them, didn't consider this argument. The government's position seems to be that the court didn't really have to consider the arguments because they weren't factually supported, because they were not part of what it identifies as the offense conduct section of the pre-sentence report, and lastly, that because the argument's frivolous, or the defense's presentation was frivolous. And while it's agreed that a district court may disregard a contention that lacks factual support, that's not really what happened here. Judge Randa didn't address the argument and find that it was without merit or without factual support. It simply never addressed them. This court has said that the district courts must state on the record its reasons for rejecting an argument. And the record in this case is devoid of any indication that Judge Randa referenced this these arguments about the specific circumstances of the offense that he raised.
Isn't it a fair argument, though, that the judge was very well aware of the circumstances surrounding the offense? But from his view, this wasn't mitigating evidence. It was really aggravating evidence, because your guy was hanging around a bunch of guys who were very deeply involved in drugs. That's what it showed. He was carrying a gun for a drug dealer. And Judge Randa was of the view that this was hardly mitigating evidence.
I think it would be appropriate, and the government suggests, that the court did just that. The problem that I see is that the record doesn't indicate that Judge Randa did look at these factors. He looked at the fact that this was a gun offense and that there were drugs involved. Suggestion that
he assessed the circumstances. He just disagreed. He disagreed 180 degrees with this man. I don't know whether you were there or with someone else.
He
just simply disagreed.
I disagree with that that idea. It would have been appropriate for the court to say, Mr. Banks, your attorney has raised several arguments here. I find that the fact that you were hanging out with these individuals and your prior record and all the history and characteristics that you present outweigh those circumstances. Or the court could have even said, Mr. Banks, I find the circumstances that you present not as mitigating circumstances but as aggravating circumstances. But the court didn't do that.
You want to address at all this material on page 19 of the transcript where, as I understand your argument, you think that Judge Randa concluded that your guy was dealing drugs?
I think that goes to the reasonableness of the sentence. But one of the other factors that the courts really are to look for in determining whether the district courts are appropriately exercising their discretion is whether the courts are relying on accurate information. And really that was the assertion that Mr. Banks was a drug dealer was something that was sort of levied at him at the sentencing hearing and not really during...
Is it a permissible or impermissible inference for the judge to draw on the facts?
I don't believe that the record supported the inference that was made. I think under certain circumstances it would be fair to make that inference. But the fact that he had one prior drug conviction for marijuana from several years back, and one prior conviction, I believe it was 4 to 5 years before the instant offense of conviction, involving less than $20 worth of cocaine, permit the inference that 4 years later he remains a drug dealer.
Mr. Euler, what does the pre-sentence report indicate about employment history?
It was very sparse. But there was also indication that Mr. Banks was a stay-at-home father. His significant other had a lengthy work history. They had several children together, and he was the caretaker of the children. I see my time's up here.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Euler.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Lipscomb?
State Police Court. I am Bill Lipscomb with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Milwaukee. Represent the United States. I was counsel at sentencing, so I'm familiar with the record. And the record does show that the court, the District Court Judge Randall, was very much interested in the nature and circumstances of the offense. He saw them differently as than defense counsel has presented here and presented there. The judge was particularly concerned about the fact the defendant was with a group of young men, that he was involved in selling two firearms, carried one of them into the ATF undercover operation, and then was also involved in the sale of drugs. And I think, as Judge Ripple noted, it was that combination of association with peers and the drugs and the guns and linking that back to his past criminal history, which was really the focus of Judge Randa's sentencing and the reason that he believed a significant sentence of 36 months within the guideline range was appropriate.
And what do we do with page 19? I mean, the judge goes one more step, and he says, you're probably dealing, too.
In a sentencing hearing, you sit there and watch the judge speak, and sometimes more is said than should be said, and often less is said than should be said. I don't think he goes and draws that direct statement that here, I find that you were dealing drugs during that period of time. He essentially says it's a reasonable inference, but what he seems to be drawing is this constant drug use and then association with those peers, which is the next paragraph, is what has him concerned, right? Because he draws that analogy in the words here. A drug user doesn't get drugs for free. Okay, something's going on. A drug user has to buy it from somewhere, of course. A constant drug user has to involve himself in, if he isn't independently wealthy, in a little dealing himself to support that habit. There's an inference. Availability here and attachment to it, associations with people with guns and drugs, and the accessibility to both of those is clear from this profile. He's more suggesting this is the profile of this person that comes before me that's shown by his criminal history, shown by the offense that's before me, right, and shown by, at least indicated by, his constant drug use and lack of employment during that period of time. That's not an unreasonable inference, right? But that's not the core thing he was relying upon in choosing that sentence of 36 months. He's not saying, I'm sentencing you to 36 months because you're a drug dealer, right? But he is a drug dealer because he was dealing drugs in this case here that was before the court.
I'm sorry, I didn't follow that last statement. How is he dealing drugs?
In the facts of the case, it's right there in the PSR, but it's right there as well in what we presented in our brief. The facts of the case of the offense were a defendant and others going into this ATF storefront operation to sell two guns and to attempt to sell crack cocaine, or at least what they purported to be crack cocaine. The agents were unwilling to buy the crack cocaine, so they didn't have the money for it at the time. The defendant and another came back the next day and actually sold the crack cocaine, or what purported to be crack cocaine. It turned out to be bunk. So those facts would indicate the defendant was in the drug business at least at the period of time of this offense. And he had a history of being involved in drug trafficking as well. Let me just conclude by the argument that I made, and I think is correct, that the mitigation arguments the defense raised here were so different from where the court was focused, and they were, in the context of the circumstances of this offense, frivolous. They were these. The defendant did not own the firearm that he carried. It didn't matter, right? The fact of ownership wasn't important. It was the possessing it and selling it that was problematic for the court. Only had the firearm temporarily. It's really of no moment. The firearm was not used in a crime. Well, if it had been used in a crime, and a crime as part of this offense, it would have added points under the guidelines. Firearm was not kept at home near children. It's entirely irrelevant. It's probably more dangerous, you could argue, that it's brought to the streets and sold into the streets. Firearm was unloaded and inoperable. It was unloaded. Whether it was inoperable or not, there are no facts that would state that it was inoperable. The best you have is defendant's statement in the statement of adjustment of responsibility of paragraph 20 that he believed it was inoperable. That's not a fact. Defendant did
so,
not.
So the defense theory is that he was selling fake crack cocaine and a gun that didn't work. Is that right?
Perhaps to really gullible ATF agents.
Okay. So, well, ready to be taken in under the circumstances.
Right. Two more. The defendant did not profit from the sale, but the defendant's own statement in the PSR at paragraph 20 is that he got $25 for transporting the individuals to the deal. Seven, not involved in negotiations for the firearm. Perhaps not. He's involved in negotiations for the crack. All of those things are weak in the great context of what the judge articulated as the nature and circumstances of the offense. They are not in the core offense conduct here. There were no findings as to those facts to the degree that they are important facts. And the court did not err in not addressing them overtly. And on that basis, we'd ask the court here to sustain the sentence below.
Thank you. You can have a minute. I know your time was up, Mr. Uller, but I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honors. The offense of conviction was a firearms offense. Part of the argument that the defense presented was in the context of how the investigation arose, and counsel alluded to the fact that this was part of this ATF storefront operation. And they were ready to be taken advantage of. The defense never disputed that the day after this offense, Mr. Banks and another individual returned to the storefront operation and sold them an ounce of baking soda that the agents believed at the time was crack cocaine. I think the inference that because of that, Mr. Banks is a drug dealer, is, and it's a stretch. The big point of Mr. Banks's argument here was not that the offense itself isn't serious. It's really that his role in this group of individuals that went into that store was sort of he was the peripheral of the group. He was on the periphery of the group. And it's our position that the district court really failed to address the nature of that argument.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
You were appointed, were you not?
I was, yes.
Thank you so much for your work on behalf of your client. This court could not really survive without lawyers who are willing to take on assignments like this. So we thank you, and we thank you, counsel, for doing a fine job as usual. The court will take the case under advisement.